Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink, technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, the White House releases new deficit projections over $150 billion more than estimated.
A Palestinian pollster says while a majority of Palestinians demand the right to return to land in Israel, just as many say they won't act on it.
For the first time, we now have a sense that the refugee issue is not a deal breaker. That's good news for the Palestinian state, good news for the refugees, good news for Israel.
Also, why some people put aside life-saving medication if it alters their looks.
If you look in the mirror and you look sick to yourself, that's a reminder every day of your disease. Whereas if you look good, you can sometimes forget that you have an underlying illness. And that's all to the good, I think.
These stories and more coming up here and now.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carol Van Dam. Hurricane Claudette has begun moving ashore along the Texas Gulf Coast north of Corpus Christi. The storm is lashing coastal areas with winds of more than 80 miles per hour, heavy rains, and a 5-foot tidal surge. Forecaster Stephen Begg at the National Hurricane Center says the storm will lose its powerful winds as it moves inland, but he warns Claudette will still cause widespread flooding.
Inland rainfall is the great danger. It appears not to be an enormously wet storm. We're forecasting 5 to 8 inches of rain as the storm moves inland. But for small streams that have a sudden torrent of water, they could be dangerous places to be near.
There are reports of damage to beachfront homes, along with downed trees and power lines. The White House today tried to cast the best light on new estimates of this year's federal budget deficit, which is expected to exceed $450 billion. NPR's Pam Fessler reports from the White House.
The estimate by the White House Office of Management and Budget is $150 billion higher than the administration predicted earlier this year. It would also be the highest nominal deficit ever, although as a percentage of the overall economy, it would be smaller than some earlier shortfalls. White House spokesman Scott McClellan said the deficit is a concern, but that the administration hopes to cut it in half over the next few years with spending limits and increased revenues due to economic growth. McClellan said the higher-than-expected deficit is the result of a slow economic recovery and the cost of war with Iraq and Homeland Security. But Democrats blame President Bush's 10-year, $350 billion tax cut, which they say has drained the budget of much-needed funds. Pam Fessler, NPR News, the White House.
Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan says the Fed is willing to cut interest rates again to bolster the nation's economy if that's what it takes.
The Federal Open Market Committee stands ready to maintain a highly accommodative stance of policy for as long as it takes to achieve a return to satisfactory economic performance.
Greenspan told a House panel the U.S. economy has underperformed over the past 2 years, but he believes growth will pick up steam in the coming months. Greenspan was delivering his semi-annual report to Congress on the state of the economy. A party in the new Iraqi Governing Council says the council's war crimes tribunal would try former President Saddam Hussein and his top aides if they are found. A spokesman for the Iraqi National Congress says the U.S. has not declared until now what it plans to do with the 55 most wanted members of Saddam's government. He says the Governing Council will try them and punish them according to Iraqi law. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Industrials are down 28 points to 9149 in active trading of 616 million shares. The Nasdaq Composite is up 2 points to 1,754. You're listening to NPR News. In NPR's business update, PeopleSoft says authorities have cleared its merger with software maker J.D. Edwards. The deal could be completed by the end of the week, which might hinder Oracle's hostile bid takeover for PeopleSoft. From San Francisco, Jason Lopez has this story.
PeopleSoft has been hurrying up its friendly merger with J.D. Edwards in order to ward off Oracle's $6.3 billion all-cash hostile takeover bid. Yesterday, PeopleSoft announced the Justice Department cleared its $1.8 billion cash-and-stock deal for J.D. Edwards. Oracle's bid for PeopleSoft could be delayed another month because antitrust authorities need more time to investigate that proposed deal. So Oracle extended its offer till the middle of August. But some analysts say that Oracle may have to swallow a combined PeopleSoft and J.D. Edwards, and that means Oracle may have to raise its bid. Analysts say if Oracle does, PeopleSoft will probably have run out of effective defenses against Oracle's hostile takeover attempts. For NPR News, I'm Jason Lopez in San Francisco.
American shoppers were back at it last month. The Commerce Department reports today that retail sales rose 0.5% last month, the best showing in 3 months. The solid hike in sales came after retail sales were flat in May, according to revised figures. Shoppers were after more than big-ticket items. They bought sporting goods, clothes, and furniture. The overwhelming majority of American companies surveyed by the Chamber of Commerce says operating ethically is a top priority. 85% say it's very important to treat employees well, and 81% say it's very important to have safe and reliable products or services. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News in Washington.
The NPR Shop now features a selection of portable shortwave and classic AM/FM radios. Online at NPR.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
$455 billion. That's the size of this year's budget deficit, according to White House projections expected to be released today. That's $155 billion more than the White House predicted just 5 months ago. And then there's another number in the billions to contemplate, the $236 billion surplus just 3 years ago. What happened? Well, there's the still flailing economy and the $79.2 billion emergency spending bill at the outset of the Iraq War and the recently passed tax cut. Joining us now on the line to discuss the implications of all this is Lawrence Kotlikoff, chairman of the Department of Economics at Boston University. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you.
Well, Professor, these deficits are still less compared to the overall size of the economy than in the Reagan years. Why should an average American worry about all this?
Well, because first of all, there's a trend. We went from a small surplus to a pretty sizable deficit. But in addition, we're talking about a period of time when the baby boomers are in the workforce. You know, there's 77 million of them, and they and we should be running absolutely enormous surpluses right now in order to build up a trust fund or resources to cover their retirement. So we're looking at direction of policy here, which is exactly the opposite of what we need to do to prepare for what's coming. What we really have, if you look at the long term, is a situation where the country is effectively bankrupt. We have the bills that are coming at us when the baby boomers retire are so big that it would take almost eliminating the government sector completely starting today to pay them off.
Because at that point, the elderly population will be so great, but the number of workers able to pay for their benefits will be much smaller.
Exactly.
That's the perfect storm. Well, let's look at things a little more immediately. What would you recommend for the average person right now insofar as how you think interest rates are going to go and bonds and stuff like that?
I expect mortgage rates and government long-term, all long-term and medium-term interest rates to start rising dramatically very quickly. So I would say to the typical homeowner, go out and borrow immediately on your – refinance your mortgage immediately if you haven't done that. Take out a bigger mortgage if you can and put the money maybe in the stock market, which is relatively low at the moment. And certainly do not buy long-term bonds because the long-term bond prices are going to come down just like the stock market came down a couple of years ago.
You know, Professor, we had some other numbers today. Consumer spending went up in a rather healthy fashion last month. Now, consumer spending accounts for two-thirds of the entire economy. Americans are buying all sorts of things, building and garden supplies and clothing. Are we fiddling while Rome burns, or is this consumer spending good news?
Well, it's certainly good news, and you know, anything that's going to help the economy is good news and help consumer confidence. But the reality is that our economy is growing about half the rate that it was growing a year ago. So we're really not doing all that well. And the government is engaging in an absolutely reckless, irresponsible fiscal policy. And it's not just this administration. The previous administration was really doing the same. They should have been running much larger surpluses and on going backwards. So you're right about Nero here is fiddling, because the reality is that if these interest rates start rising dramatically, once the bond traders get their heads on straight about what's going on, it's really going to put the economy in a major tailspin and put us into a deeper deficit. So we have, as I said, you know, if you really look at this in a long-term perspective, the country's bankrupt, and that means the government's going to have to start printing money to pay its bills, which is going to lead interest rates to go sky high. So we could end up very quickly in the kind of situation of Argentina.
Professor Karlikoff, we're going to have to cut you off at this point. I wish we had a little more time to discuss all this, but thanks very much for joining us on this.
My pleasure.
Lawrence Karlikoff is chairman of the Department of Economics at Boston University.
The findings of a leading Palestinian pollster were overshadowed this week when he was attacked and pelted with eggs by an angry mob. Khalil Shikaki's study probed Palestinian opinions about the so-called right of return, the belief that 4 million Palestinians have the right to return to their ancestral homes inside Israel, something even Palestinian moderates concede would overwhelm the Jewish state, making Jews a minority in Israel. Dr. Shikaki, director of the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research, says the issue is perhaps a little more negotiable than previously thought, and he joins us now from Ramallah. Welcome, Dr. Shikaki.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, first of all, how are you?
Can't be better.
You've recovered then from the nastiness on Sunday.
Indeed, I did.
Okay. Well, tell us, we talked briefly about the poll results yesterday, but can you remind us, how did the majority of Palestinians respond to this issue of right of return in your poll?
Well, the overwhelming majority of Palestinians demand the right of return. They consider it to be sacred. However, what we have tried to do in this survey is to go beyond that. We wanted to know, how will the Palestinian refugees behave once they have the right of return guaranteed and that they have the right to choose? Where would they choose their place of permanent residency? And we have found that only a small minority of 10% want Israel to be their home's future place of residence.
Doctor, did the survey also bring up the issue of compensation, in other words, choosing between a right of return and some other monetary compensation instead of a right of return?
They would indeed accept the compensation, but they want the right of return guaranteed, and then they want to live in the Palestinian state. Compensation is only for the lost property that they have left in Israel.
And some Israelis might say, how can we trust your poll?
Well, one thing for sure. The pollsters can always be accused, whether one side or the other. There is no doubt that one survey is not enough. There is no doubt that other surveys must be done among refugees so that our findings can be verified. Once the tests are duplicated and the findings come out similar, I think this will give the Israelis even further assurances that indeed the risk they are taking is worth taking.
Doctor, how are you interpreting this? Is this in the West we have a word, closure. I mean, you might have it there as well, but is this? Do you think that's what it is that they're asking for?
There's no doubt that part of it is the need for closure. If you wish to close the file, what they have been waiting for is recognition of their moral right to return. And I think there is a deep psychological need to have that right recognized so that there would be closure.
We're now in phase one of the so-called roadmap to peace. The right of return is a topic that's not to be dealt with until phase three. That's in 2004 to 2005. What does your research now tell you about this issue being resolved by then?
That for the first time, we now have a sense that the refugee issue is not a deal breaker, that this is a win-win situation for everybody, that the refugees who insist on the right of return can have the right granted to them, because Israelis would not have to confront a situation where the demographic balance would be changed as a result of their willingness to recognize the right of return. That's good news for the Palestinian state, good news for the refugees, good news for Israel.
Well, Dr. Shikaki, as you said, the first of many polls, I'm sure.
And I hope that it will be duplicated soon.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Halil Shikaki, director of the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research in the West Bank.
For those who believe the world's climate is changing in ways that endanger all of us, figuring out a way to reverse the trend is urgent business. But how? Well, environmental lawyers are beginning to pursue a new approach, suing corporations that they believe are responsible for problems like global warming. It gets complicated, not surprisingly, very quickly. Like, do you sue sellers of fossil fuels or users of fossil fuels, or both? And just where do you sue? In which court? Well, to explore what the Financial Times has called the next big legal battlefield, we're joined now by Jonathan Weiner, who's a professor of environmental law at Duke University. And, Professor, how widespread do you think this litigation could become?
I think right now it's just in the very preliminary stages, and it may wither away or it could grow over time.
Yeah.
It's interesting to compare to the tobacco litigation, which took several decades to grow from a series of losses to a much more robust litigation strategy.
Right. It could be very difficult to pinpoint blame in many of these cases, though, could it not? Some climate change historically is just caused naturally.
That's a major challenge for plaintiffs who are trying to sue individual companies. And each company can argue that the science of causation of global climate change is very uncertain. And it can also argue that even if it's clear that human beings are changing the climate, which is in dispute, that that individual company's contribution is trivial.
As an environmental lawyer yourself, do you think it's a good approach?
Well, I think what's interesting is there are several different legal approaches being tried. One is for individual victims or their organizations to sue companies. A second is to sue the government for either funding activities that might contribute to climate change or for failing to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. Another strategy that's just emerging is for shareholders of companies to introduce petitions or possibly lawsuits against their own companies for the companies failing to respond to new regulations.
I see.
And I think each of those different strategies will play out differently.
Now, where would these lawsuits be brought?
Well, those lawsuits that I just mentioned are typically being brought in United States courts. There's another possible litigation strategy of filing lawsuits in, under international law in, say, the International Court of Justice against the U.S. government. But that's limited because the jurisdiction of those courts is at the discretion of the defendant governments.
How likely do you think it could be that environmental lawyers could begin to pursue corporations, and whether they were able to prove their case or not, so tie corporations up and cost them so much money that policies might change?
I think the lesson from the tobacco and airbags cases is that these lawsuits can grow over time, and that especially if a large institutional actor or set of actors like the insurance companies gets involved, that brings a lot more legal muscle to the table.
Hmm.
In tobacco, the major settlement of the tobacco companies with the states was really with the state insurance agencies, which sued for reimbursement of the health insurance claims they had paid to cigarette smokers. What's interesting in the climate change litigation will be whether insurance companies who would have to pay the claims of victims of storm damage or crop losses will, as a group or as a large institutional block, bring their legal strategies to bear against whether it's private companies or governments for greenhouse gas emissions.
Mm. An interesting new legal avenue, legal battlefield. Jonathan Weiner, thanks very much for joining us on it.
Thank you.
Jonathan Weiner is a professor of environmental law at Duke Law School. He joined us from Durham, North Carolina.
Just ahead, the risks and benefits of choosing vanity over health.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The HIV virus is no longer the immediate death sentence it once was, at least in the developing world. But the disease it causes, AIDS, is still a serious chronic health threat, one that's ultimately fatal. So imagine a patient stopping his AIDS medication because he doesn't like the way it makes him look. Well, according to Here and Now's regular health columnist Judy Foreman, that's not such an unusual decision. Patients putting their physical appearance before their health, even their survival. Judy Foreman joins us in the studio now to talk about this. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Well, I'm fine, but this is, it really struck me. You talked to someone who did not want their name used.
That's right.
Who is ill but doesn't take his meds. Why?
Because some of the AIDS drugs cause what they call lipoatrophy. It's sort of a loss of fat tissue. And most of us might think that was really a good thing, but not if it's really isolated, not if it's just like in your cheeks or fat gets deposited in strange lumpy places in your body. He found that his cheeks got sunken, you know, that gaunt kind of ill look that some AIDS patients have really made him conspicuous. And he hasn't told the people where he works that he's got AIDS. I mean, he really keeps it a secret. So the fact that his face gave away his secret, if you will, really disturbed him.
Well, I mean, there's so many questions here. First of all, couldn't he have said it was something else? And we would all hope that there'd be no shame, but it's a personal choice on his part. What did doctors tell you about his choice?
Well, his doctor, to whom I also talked, actually was very supportive because, when your looks give away your private medical secret, it can be really damaging to you, at least to your mental health, and who knows, maybe possibly at some level to your physical health. But this doctor was willing to go along with the patient and kind of juggle the AIDS meds and say, all right, let's go off them for 3 to 6 months, and then if your disease gets worse, go back on them for a while and kind of try to balance the issues of beauty and health, which is actually a very common thing, not just with AIDS, but for a lot of different illnesses.
Well, this did set you on a sort of pilgrimage to find other ways in which we do this, because people, I will have a hard time understanding weighing your emotional health and how you feel about how you look against your real health. I mean, you could die if you don't take your meds.
In this case, this man certainly could die. For other people, it's not quite that extreme necessarily, but it can be. For instance, with a lot of psychiatric illnesses, particularly schizophrenia, some of the medications cause people to gain, on average, 15 pounds, sometimes 100 pounds. And that's terrible for your vanity, and it's also bad for your health. So that means that a lot of people who should be on those meds don't take them, although there are now some new drugs that don't have that weight gain problem. Mm. A lot of people have rheumatoid arthritis and they have to go on steroids. But again, that can make you end up with this moon face, this really chubby look. And people hate that look so much that they often cut down on their steroids more than they should.
And you talked to other doctors who pointed out that especially if someone has a fatal illness, they might decide that rather than be deformed in some way, they have a certain quality of life, if it's shorter, if they look better.
That's exactly right. And it seems strange if you haven't been in that position, but I really salute these people who make these decisions because it really is so tough. And I think deciding that your quality of life matters that much to you is a perfectly reasonable thing to decide.
Yeah. And as you point out, people do things to themselves all the time, and they're not sick.
All over the world. Yeah, I think it's different when you're not sick. But like in Africa, women wear gold necklaces that are, and so many of them that their neck gets elongated and they can't ever take them off because their neck would collapse. We American women wear high heels. And I actually called the American Podiatric Medical Association and they said, yeah, 72% of American women still wear high heels, even though it's known that this causes foot mm-hmm. pains and can make your bunions worse and your hammer toes worse. I mean, we all make these decisions. It's just that usually they're not life-threatening.
Right. We make choices every day about how we look that affect our health.
That's right. That's right. And more often than I think most people realize, people choose or tip their balance in favor of looks.
Yeah. How is the AIDS patient that you spoke to? How is he doing?
He's doing excellently. His disease has been sort of held in abeyance, and he's in close contact with his doctor. They watch things very carefully, and if the virus starts to build up again, then he'll go back on the meds. I should also say that for a lot of AIDS patients, there are injections that you can get in your face to kind of build up those sunken cheek areas, and he's doing that as well. Yeah. But in his case, he didn't think that was going to be enough unless he went off the meds as well.
It's so funny. We think of the issue of vanity. as being a superficial thing, but it sounds as if you're saying that it's a little more fundamental than that.
I think it really is more fundamental, and I think it's universal. I think attractiveness matters to yourself when you look in the mirror and to other people who react to you. Also, one other thing that some of the doctors I talked to pointed out to me is that if you look in the mirror and you look sick to yourself, that's a reminder every day of your disease, whereas if you look good, you can sometimes forget that you have an underlying illness, and that's all to the good, I think.
Well, Judy, thank you as usual.
You're very welcome.
Judy Foreman, Here and Now's regular health commentator. To read her syndicated medical column, visit our website, here-now.org.
As if there weren't already enough reasons to shed those extra pounds, a new study links being overweight with an increased risk of Alzheimer's disease. Published yesterday in the journal Archives of Internal Medicine, the study followed almost 400 Swedish senior citizens for 18 years, much longer than previous similar studies. The new study found a striking relationship between being overweight at age 70 and the chances of later developing Alzheimer's. To put it in perspective, a woman who is 5 feet 5 inches tall and 145 pounds increases her risk of Alzheimer's disease by more than 30% for each additional 6 pounds she gains. Although the researchers found this increased risk only among women, they say it's unclear whether that's because of a real difference between the sexes or simply because of the smaller number of men in the study. But with nearly two-thirds of American adults overweight, and women over the age of 50 especially likely to be obese, the new findings may have tremendous importance for public health.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, the battle between a governor, a developer, and an architect over construction on the World Trade Center site.
And we talk with Martin Espada about his poem honoring the Windows on the World workers killed on 9/11. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, some Democratic presidential candidates and the president come under fire from the NAACP for not attending their annual convention.
Al Sharpton drew perhaps the loudest applause of the day yesterday when he said, why is it that the president can go to Africa and meet with African leaders, but when he comes home, doesn't take the time to meet with African-American leaders?
Also, songstress Linda Etter is back where she began, Broadway.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. Residents in low-lying areas along the Gulf Coast of Texas are being urged to leave as Hurricane Claudette bears down. In Galveston, waves are crashing over a 17-foot-high seawall, and roofs have been blown off some beachfront homes. The AP's Mark Babinek is there.
Power's been kind of on and off in the Port Lavaca area and some of the other towns. Some of the towns real close to the coast have virtually been abandoned, and those staying in are behind closed doors in boarded-up homes.
Forecasters say the storm is becoming better organized as it approaches the coast, but that it should steadily weaken once it comes ashore. The Bush administration wrote a new chapter in economic history today with a forecast of unprecedented budget deficits. It's projecting a record $455 billion in red ink this year and a deficit of $475 billion next year. Democrats say the deficit will be even worse. They say the forecast doesn't include the future cost of the war in Iraq. Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan says the Fed stands ready to cut interest rates again if needed to boost the economy. The board has been concerned that inflation is falling to such a low level that there's a danger that the sluggish economy might actually trigger a prolonged bout of deflation. At its meeting last month, the Fed reduced a key interest rate to the lowest level since 1958. The next day, banks reduced their prime rate to 4%, the lowest benchmark rate for millions of consumer and business loans since 1959. The new governing leaders of Iraq are getting ready to prosecute former members of the Saddam Hussein regime. The governing council that was put in place by the United States says it's going to set up a special court system to prosecute those responsible for mass executions, torture, and other abuses. But an official with Human Rights Watch is challenging the plan, saying putting former victims of Saddam Hussein and his regime in the position of judging their tormentors might not result in justice. Rebels in Liberia today are pleading for the United States to send in peacekeepers, but a U.S. diplomat is playing down the possibility of a major role for American troops. The diplomat indicates that any American role would likely be a supporting one, providing logistical and financial help to West African forces monitoring the ceasefire. On Wall Street at this hour, stocks are mixed. The Dow was down 15 at 91.62. The Nasdaq is ahead 6 at 17.61. It's 33 minutes past the hour.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Three of the nine Democratic candidates running for president in 2004 have been declared persona non grata by the NAACP. Richard Gephardt, Dennis Kucinich, and Joseph Lieberman opted to not attend the Florida convention with the six candidates who did share the Miami stage yesterday. Also absent from the convention was President George Bush, whose political capital, according to NAACP President Kwesi Mamfumi, is now the equivalent of Confederate dollars. Well, joining us to talk about the candidates' relationship to the NAACP is Peter Walston. He's covering the story for the Miami Herald. Hi, Peter.
Hi, how are you?
Well, I'm fine. Six out of nine Democratic candidates attend the convention. Those who didn't apologized. They said they had other commitments. Kucinich, for instance, said he wanted to vote in Washington. Why the intense anger?
Well, I think the leaders of the NAACP consider their organization to be the nation's oldest and frankly, most important civil rights organization. And to have several of the Democratic presidential candidates not come was really viewed as an insult.
Right. Is there an assumption on the NAACP's part that there's an assumption on the Democratic candidates' part that they're in the bag, that they're already lined up as voters?
I think that there is that tension that leaders of the NAACP and activists there feel that their votes have been taken for granted. And not many people think that there will be a lot of black votes going for President Bush next year. But still, there's a feeling that they've been taken for granted, and that could be damaging for Democrats if black voters have that feeling and decide to stay home.
I'm wondering, too, if the language of President Kwesi Mfumi, which was very strong, was in part also because it seems as if the whole convention has been overshadowed by President Bush's trip to Africa.
Yeah, and that has been another topic of discussion at the convention, which is the sense that, of course, the president also didn't come to the NAACP convention, despite the fact that he did make a big show of going to Africa. And in fact, Al Sharpton drew perhaps the loudest applause of the day yesterday when he said, why is it that the president can go to Africa and meet with African leaders, but when he comes home, doesn't take the time to meet with African-American leaders?
Peter, what is your sense? Is the NAACP the viable, important organization that it has been in the past when it comes to candidates?
Well, six of the nine candidates did come, and two of them, John Edwards and John Kerry, were still debating whether to even attend the forum into Sunday night, and finally decided to come under pressure from Mfume and from the other leadership. And all those candidates did agree that it would have been a really bad move to not attend. I think that when you're looking at an important mainstream African-American group that a lot of black voters might look to for guidance, the NAACP remains strong, especially in the Democratic Party.
And what about the perception on the part of the participants of the candidates on the stage? From a reading of it, it sounds as if there might have even been some uncomfortable moments. Lily White candidates trying to get across their connection with black people.
Yeah, it felt a little bit awkward at times. You know, for instance, you had John Edwards, who believes his appeal is as a Southerner, who experienced segregation, and he talked about his experiences with segregation, and yet, of course, he's white and couldn't have experienced segregation in the South the way that a black person could have. And Howard Dean, who said, you know, the real key is for me as a white person to go talk to white people about race relations, which was an interesting message, but there were some murmurs in the crowd the way it came out. And John Kerry talking about his experiences with a black soldier in the war, and Bob Graham talking about he called himself a son of the segregated South, even though he's a multimillionaire who grew up in Miami and is white.
It's a tricky path to walk.
Yeah.
Well, Peter, thank you.
Thank you.
Peter Walston, reporter for the Miami Herald, covering the NAACP convention in that city.
Whether or not to teach children who are not native English speakers in their own language is often a bitter debate. The latest focal point is Massachusetts, where, appropriately enough for a complex issue, the story is complicated. Last November, nearly 70% of voters approved a ballot initiative which replaced bilingual education with English immersion classes. Then the democratically controlled legislature amended the law with certain exemptions. But the Republican governor vetoed those exemptions. And now, yesterday, the legislature overrode the governor's veto. Well, to try to sort all this out and talk about the state of bilingual education in Massachusetts and beyond, we're joined by Dr. Rosalie Petalino-Porter, who was chair for the English for the Children campaign, the group which pushed the ballot initiative in favor of English immersion. And welcome, Dr. Porter.
Hello.
Dr. Porter, what do you think of the legislature's actions? I understand the legislature only now exempted 12 small programs around the state and only would allow replacing English immersion with so-called two-way bilingual programs in which children are taught both English and their native language. Why is that a problem?
It sounds like a small change, but in fact, it could be the opening for some mischief. In other words, districts that want to evade the law and keep their bilingual programs, their native language teaching programs, could try to find their way through this two-way teaching loophole. The law was voted in by 68% of the voters, and it is the law of the state of Massachusetts. We expect, for the most part, that English immersion teaching will go into effect in September.
Now, Dr. Porter, you do have a particular insight into this. You immigrated to the United States from Italy when you were six, and you didn't have bilingual courses, did you?
There were no kinds of special help when I came to America. No bilingual, no English teaching. You just sat at the back of the classroom until you picked up the language. It was terrible.
I see. So you don't want children who speak another language to sit in the back of a classroom immersed in a language they don't understand. You want them to be taught somewhat aggressively English.
Absolutely. And I was a Spanish bilingual teacher for several years. If you want children to learn English as soon as possible, you give them special help in English.
Can't some children fall behind, though, if the English immersion program, for one thing, is not particularly well done?
English immersion programs are working extremely well in states that passed this law a couple of years ago.
Are you completely opposed to these so-called two-way bilingual programs where children are essentially taught in both languages?
I am not, and I have written on two-way programs. They can be very effective. I believe in children keeping their home language, but I think the first priority for public schools is to give these children the help they need in mastering the language of the community and of the school and of what they will need to succeed in our society.
Dr. Rosalie Porter, thank you very much for joining us on this.
I'm so happy to have had the chance to talk on your program.
Thanks so much. Dr. Rosalie Porter Petalino was chair of the English for the Children campaign in Massachusetts.
Still to come, her Broadway debut got rave reviews, and now after a six-year break, Linda Etter is headed back to the Great White Way.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Your wedding day. It's a once-in-a-lifetime occasion. Okay, well, maybe it's a twice or three times in a lifetime occasion. But some New York City brides have managed to walk down the aisle with as many as 27 men. They are not, according to city officials, overly optimistic. They are career brides who marry illegal immigrants for a fee and enable the short-term grooms to get a green card and stay in the country. Joining us on the line is New York City Clerk Victor Robles. And Victor, do I understand that there are career brides and grooms?
Yes, there are. It could be either male or female.
Well, how'd you figure out that this was happening?
Well, I was a new city clerk, just recently appointed. I'm coming across the Brooklyn Bridge to go to work when I hear on radio news where an individual was married more than six times. And so when I came into my office, I asked my chief of staff and my counsel to look at this report to find out that it is correct, that they got six licenses within the city of New York, of which I oversee. Now, as a new clerk, I asked see how was it possible to find out that they were only doing a one-year search. So an individual will wait a year and a day and then go to another office of mine because I happen to have a office in each of the five boroughs of the city of New York.
Mm-hmm.
What I did was then I changed that policy where now we do 10-year searches.
Right. And now you share the information from office to office and with the attorney general.
Absolutely. With the district attorneys and also with the U.S. attorney's office.
This concept isn't new. People have seen the film Green Card starring Gerard Depardieu and Andy McDowell. The number of repeat marriages is incredible. How could these men and women go into offices? Didn't somebody recognize them after a while?
Well, what happens is that, again, you know, after a certain time, and depending upon the leadership, I'm a hands-on person, so I look at all of these things. What happens is that it's an affidavit, which you're swearing that the contents of the information is correct.
Right.
And so that affidavit is the instrument that I'm using to forward it to the district attorney's offices when they violate the law.
And previously they were lying and nobody was cross-checking. And what has happened to some of these people?
Well, right now you have six cases that for the first time not only have they been arrested, but there will be prosecution. There are other cases that are in the hopper. They've been investigated. Most recently also the the Secretary of Homeland Security is asked to look into that in terms of possible deporting individuals for using the marriage as a means of staying within the country. Mm-hmm. So at least we're now cooperating jointly. Mm-hmm.
The repeat offender would get a fee. The other bride or groom, whichever it might be, would get to stay in the country and get benefits, including Social Security and unemployment. Are there people, have you come across people who are doing this not for a fee, but because they feel, you know, they're making some sort of gesture to an immigrant who would have a hard time getting in the country, who think they're doing a good thing?
In the short time I've been the city clerk and what I've looked at, it really it's about a business and really it's about money. Mm. I haven't come across a what I call a do-gooder. Right now, as I see in the information that I have, it's really about a business. Anyone can get anywhere between $1,000 to $5,000 a pop.
Really?
Yes, ma'am.
A lot of ears just perked up, Victor. But we should remind people that it's now you're going to be looking at it a lot closer.
Oh, absolutely. And we will forward that again to the proper prosecuting agencies.
Yeah. Well, Victor, the movie Green Card was funny. But in a post-9/11 world, this is a pretty serious issue.
Oh, absolutely. And all I can tell you is that there's a new sheriff in town, and I will not tolerate violating the law. I took an oath, and I intend to enforce it.
Mm. Victor, thank you.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
You too. Victor Robles is city clerk of New York City.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
When singer Linda Eder made her Broadway debut in Jekyll and Hyde 6 years ago, critics and fans of musical theater fawned over her and compared her vocal talent to no less than Barbara Streisand.
Now I see a world I've never seen before. Your love is
That's Linda Eder singing Someone Like You from 1997's Tony Award-winning Broadway hit, Jekyll and Hyde. Well, since Eder's debut, it's been nonstop recording, touring, and parenting. But no Broadway. That is, until now. This summer, rehearsals start for Eder's Great White Way return in the new musical, Camille Claudel. Well, recently, Here and Now producer April Peavy spoke with Linda Eder before a solo performance at Symphony Hall in Boston, where Eder was performing Broadway standards from her new CD, Broadway My Way.
I've often walked down the street before.
I've been singing since I could probably open my mouth just to make a sound. It was something as a child that I loved to do. Always in private, though. I never sang publicly until I got into choir in high school.
Knowing I'm on the street where you live.
What is it about Broadway, the standards, that just grabbed your heart at such a young age?
Well, my influences were, early on, were three women. One was Eileen Farrell, an opera singer. And, of course, Judy Garland, watching The Wizard of Oz as a kid. She became a big influence of mine. And then when I was a young teenager, that's when I discovered Streisand. So those three women really influenced my style, and obviously that, you know, lends toward theatrical kind of material.
Don't tell me not to live, just sit and putter. Life's candy and the sun's a ball of butter. Don't bring around a cloud to rain on my parade.
And now your new CD is called Broadway My Way, and in this collection you perform songs like Don't Rain on My Parade by Barbara Streisand, Some People by Ethel Merman.
Some people can get a thrill knitting sweaters and sitting still. That's okay for some people who don't know their life.
Songs that really, in many ways, have defined the women who sang them. So, getting back to the title, Broadway My Way, what is it that you do to these songs to make it yours?
Well, I got the idea for the title because in my concert I've always done a certain number of, obviously, Broadway songs. And some of them were done in arrangements that are very different than what they're done in the Broadway show. Because we're not tied to having to portray a character. We can do it basically on the strength of the music alone, not just the lyric content. And so they developed, and I had that in my repertoire. And also I had a song called Man of La Mancha, which, as you know, is a song normally sung by a man, and it became one of my biggest numbers in my concert. It's still what I close all my shows with. So knowing I had that material, that's where I got the idea for Broadway My Way. So everything on the album, it sort of tied it all together, this weird mix of things I chose. I tried to choose songs that were not necessarily on every single album, Broadway album that you might pick up, something that was a little bit different. And then the arrangements are just twisted in some way toward, you know, what I would like them to be outside of a show. So everything, you know, has a little bit of that in it.
Hear me now, for the bleak and unbearable world, now our base and debauched as can be. And the knight with his banner all bravely unfurled, now hurls down his gauntlet to thee. I am thy Don Quixote, the Lord of La Mancha, destroyer of evil am I. I will march to the sound of the trumpets of glory, forever to conquer or die.
Hear me. Now, one of the songs on the album is A New Life, which in many ways has become your signature song.
A new dream. I have one I know that very few dream.
It was written, co-written by your husband, Frank Wildhorn. Are you the inspiration behind the songs? Do you collaborate in any way?
Well, I guess I am. He calls me his muse these days, and he does write very much with my voice in his head. I think what he tends to write the best is what I tend to sing the best. And we're both very much in love with theater songs, theatrical songs, although he, you know, he has a very strong foothold in the pop world as well.
New world, this one thing I want to ask of you once before it's time to say a new world. Once we change to prove the cynics wrong.
When we started out, you know, I was just happy to sing whatever they put in front of me. But as the years went by, he learned to respect my musical opinion as well, and it's become a really good collaboration. I've had input on lyrics. I've actually written some lyrics for songs. I've had input on the melodies. Sometimes I've had input on the actual structure of a song, and he's very open to that, and it's a wonderful thing. It's, you know, to be a singer nowadays and be married to a composer whose work you admire, you know, what better position in the world could you have than that?
I wonder if when all is done, anyone heard my voice. But from the start we have no choice. Our journeys just begin.
Finally, there's a song called Gold, again co-written by your husband. And a lot of Broadway fans are waiting for this show to open, because Gold is part of an upcoming musical called Camille Claudel. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the song and tell me about this new musical.
Well, I've had a lot of desire to go back to doing theater, you know, ever since I left Jekyll and Hyde, which was my only Broadway experience. And I loved it, but I had a child shortly after I left the show and just went back to doing what I had been doing all along, which is concerts and recording. But there's a part of me that loves theater and always will, and I want to do it again, and I want to be better at it and learn. And so we've been developing this musical about Camille Claudel. She was a real woman from the turn of the century, a French sculptor, and she became the muse and the mistress of a very famous French sculptor named Rodin. He helped her. He knew she was very talented. They had a torrid affair, and it's a very operatic sort of piece, very heightened emotions, which makes for good musicals. The song Gold is based on something that Rodin said about Camille. He said he showed her where to find the gold, but the gold that she found is her own. And it's the final thing you hear in the musical, and it's basically Camille summing up her life, wondering if when she died, she didn't know if anyone was even going to see her art. I've actually recorded the song. I re-recorded the song Gold for this new album. It's on my prior album, which was actually titled Gold. But I felt after we had done some readings and I'd actually rehearsed the part, I felt I knew her better and I wanted to be able to re-record it because I felt I could bring a lot more to the song. And I think it's a wonderful song. I think it's one of the best songs my husband's ever written.
There were nights the moon above me stirred and let me grab a hold. My hands have touched the gold.
So can we expect Camille Claudel to open any time before 2003 is over?
Well, we're going to be starting rehearsals July 22nd at the Goodspeed Theater, and that's where we'll start it. And unless we make a major misstep, you know, hopefully we'll be on Broadway with it soon.
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I know my voice was just a whisper, but someone must have heard.
Linda Etter speaking to Here and Now producer April Peavy. For more information on Etter's new CD, Broadway My Way, or info on her summer tour and pre-Broadway performances of Camille Claudel, check out our website at here-now.org.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
I once held the gold. Funding
for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.